Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 133 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Today's episode features not only one of my favorite writers, but also a sweet deal for people interested in my own latest book. So stick around to the end for a great show and a sweet treat. In the last decade or so, I've been incredibly happy to see a rising tide of history books and articles that are written to meet the people where they are. Public history that's full of life and energy, and that hooks even more people and brings them into our world. As regular listeners will know, this is my own personal passion, so it's always a pleasure to interview a writer who does it better than maybe anyone else in the world today, Dan Jones. Dan is the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books, including The Plantagenets, The Warrior Kings and Queens Who Made England, and Crusaders, an epic history of the wars for the Holy Lands. He's also a familiar face on your Netflix account as the presenter of Secrets of Great British Castles, as well as various other documentaries such as Britain's Bloody Crown. In addition to a short medieval ghost story he released just before Halloween called The Tale of the Tailor and the Three Dead Kings, Dan's latest book is Powers and Thrones, A New History of the Middle Ages. Here's our conversation about telling the story of the entire Middle Ages in one book, getting back to studying kings instead of ordinary people, and how humor and history can go hand in hand. All right, well, welcome back, Dan, to talk about Powers and Thrones. I love this book, and it's always so good to see you. How you doing?
I'm back. Thank you for that welcome back. I'm a repeat offender.
And we're back. Yeah, congratulations on the new book. I think it's doing super well everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I don't look at the numbers, really, but people seem to like it, and I put a lot into it. I'm happy with it.
Great.
So that's just the best judge for me is, am I happy with it? I'm pretty happy with it.
That's very zen of you.
I'm getting more zen. Do you know what I mean? I'm getting more zen as I get older. But I've now got a dog sitting in my lap, if anyone wants a visual reference. But I'm getting more zen. I do a lot of yoga now. And I listen to my Peloton instructors. And they're full of good advice. Good life advice. Advice about just not getting worked up about stuff. So I'm getting old as well, you know?
Wow. Older. Yeah, I still got you beat there, but not by much. But yeah, I've noticed you're more zen. I love this book, though, and I think it's in here. Like, it's you have this relaxed feel to this book. But, I mean, you do work really hard, and I think that because you have, like, a certain level of quote-unquote fame, I think people think that maybe you just toss these books off, but you work your ass off for these books. I want to recognize that myself.
Oh, well, thank you. That's kind of the trick, though, because I like to read books that have a flow and have a shape and have a sort of ease and have a laconic narrative pace and style to them. And that's the style I'm still trying to work on. I've been trying to work on for 15 years or whatever it is. But of course, to make things look easy, usually you've got to put a lot in under the surface. And so I work very hard on the architectural shape of the book. And it goes without saying that the writing process and research is time consuming. And it's also, okay, there's a lot of accumulated knowledge now. It's my 10th book. So you can't write a big book like this. You know, it's nearly 250,000 words. It covers 1,100 years. You can't do it justice without working hard. And it would also be unfair to myself and to readers to do it without working hard.
That's true. Right. So this is like a huge book. You cover the entire Middle Ages. So my first question for you is, are you crazy? Are you legitimately crazy? Where did this come from?
Okay, I'll tell you where it came from. Partly I've been going in this direction a little bit, you know. Second book was Plantagenets, but I'd written books on Peasant Revolt and Magna Carta and the Templars, which are relatively contained stories. And in the case of Peasant Revolt and Magna Carta, really only cover about a year. But I prefer working on a big scale. You know, Plantagenets, Wars of the Roses, Crusaders, the medieval books I've done, those are the books I've really sort of felt like, yeah, this is the scale I like working on. I've just done Crusaders. We talked about that. And I was thinking, well, what? How would you get bigger? Do I go and do dynastic history of another country that's not England? Do I do a sort of a big burst outside the Middle Ages and do a big history of Britain? I thought about these things, but I wanted to do a big book. It was going to be book number 10. And then my publisher, my British publisher, Anthony Cheetham, just sort of buttonholed me one day, and he just had an idea, as is his wont. This has been the key to his success over the years, is just having an idea every day and knowing a writer that he thinks is stupid enough to attempt it. And he just said, you should do a history of the Middle Ages, sack of Rome to sack of Rome. He meant 410 to 1527. What do you reckon? I said, yeah, sure. That sounds like
as great you do. Guess. Yeah, sure.
but it was, you know, it's a conversation. He's a forceful man, and we're old friends. But he's also got this ability to inspire you as a writer, to make you believe that you're capable of doing something. What a wonderful talent. And anyway, I said, yes. And so that was it, done. And then I went away and wrote up a treatment for both my American publishing partners and my British publishing partners. And I was like, do you know what? This could be like super dope. This could be really, really fun. Because we're in a time when the trend often can be towards hyper-specialization. You know, as I understand it, that's the broad direction of movement in academic circles. And you see a lot of it in trade publishing as well. People are somewhat leery of attacking very, very big subjects. And I think it's often good to go against the grain. So I thought, yeah, why not? Let's do it. And I thought it was also a chance to, A, demystify the Middle Ages for a general audience, should they need it demystifying any further. And B, to kind of do a book that was more reflective. I'd always actually, with the medieval books, been quite concerned to shut out the modern world as I was writing them, because I found that that was a good way of keeping a sort of deep mood inside the book. But I thought with this book, if you write a history of the whole of the Middle Ages, there are going to emerge very big trends, very big themes, which could then speak to a modern audience. Yeah, let's take themes like, how did climate change shape and frame the Middle Ages? How did mass migration shape and frame the Middle Ages? How did pandemic disease affect the grand shape of the Middle Ages? Because we're living in a world of uncertainty and change, and it just struck me that there would be a way of writing a history of the Middle Ages, a new history of the Middle Ages, that could chime with now. And I thought that would be most possible for me if I worked on a very big scale.
Yeah, I mean, for people who want to hear about how you work, we talked a lot about just the writing process when you were here for Crusaders, so they could go back and listen to that. So we don't need to go over that too much.
You don't want to hear that rehashed now.
Well, you know, you and I can talk about writing structure for a long time, but this is not like the writing medieval podcast.
This isn't a writing workshop. This is a history. Let's get into it.
Right. Well, I like what you're saying about this, and I think this is what makes the book so good. You're talking about hyper-specialization in academia, and I do see that a lot around those issues you're talking about, like climate change and things like that. But so far, I haven't seen anyone that's trying to tackle the entire period with those things in mind. So I think it is time for a new history of it that's covering all of those things, is accessible to people, and it actually touches on those things that are so to the forefront of our minds right now, like climate change, pandemic disease, all those things. So I think it really
works.
Yeah,
well, look, I think you've got to reach out, haven't you? And and meet audiences halfway. That's something I've learned from working in all sorts of different media. That, I mean, I'm not necessarily talking to people listening to your podcast, because I've assumed that by definition, people here have an interest in the Middle Ages already. But it may amaze everyone to hear that there are a few poor souls left in the world who haven't yet come across the Middle Ages, or at least yet fallen in love with them. Look, there's a general audience out there that I think, if you want to reach out and say, hey, come into our world, come see what the Middle Ages is all about, come enjoy this stuff that's bonded us over the years. Well, look, you've got to meet them halfway and say, because the immediate riposte to that invitation is, why should I do that? Middle Ages is terrible, isn't it? Whenever I read a newspaper, it says medieval is a synonym for bad. And it was just a load of dudes like wailing on each other, wasn't it? Well, actually, there are things that you can reflect on in this 1,000-year middle millennium that may make you think differently. Okay, so that's part of the pitch. And I also think, and this slightly touched on your earlier question about why do a big history of the Middle Ages, is that, again, if you look across the big, broad market of people who are interested in history and not just medieval history, there's an enormous amount of information. We're battered and bombarded with information, and the amount of possible things to go and look at is ever increasing. And so I think that often it helps to offer the readers a one-stop shop, you know, to say, look, you're interested in the Middle Ages, you don't know where to start? Okay, I'll tell you what, here you go.
Yeah,
this is where you start. And then each of these 16 chapters in Powers and Thrones could be a lifetime of interest for you. If you're interested in Byzantium, great. If you're interested in the Black Death and post-plague reconstruction, great. You know, it's all there. Just go and see what you like and follow your interests.
I mean, you and I are totally on the same wavelength about all of this stuff. So when you were writing Crusaders, one of the things I noticed about that, and I think we talked about, was that you really tried to pull out some ordinary people that you didn't see very much. So you pull these people to the front and they often started a chapter or helped people through the chapter as kind of a way to bring them through. And for this one, you have to get back to all of these big names that people might be familiar with already. So how is that for you, coming back to these big names that you had kind of worked with before and then worked away from before? How is it to come back to these huge figures again?
The big swinging dicks. yeah, look,
I didn't say that. Well, you said that.
I said that. By the nature of the book, it's a history of the Middle Ages. The subtitle is A New History of the Middle Ages, and I thought about lots of different possible definitions of what that could be. I thought, well, one new history of the Middle Ages could just be, you know, history of the Middle Ages through people you've never heard of, through the sort of painstaking reconstructing the lives of peasants and the marginalized. That would be a super valid approach to it. Someone should do that, in fact.
Yeah.
Someone listening, go write that book. Maybe they already have. But I also thought, well, for me, the essence of this book is bigness. And so I'm going to make it a greatest hits book. And as you say, I've just done Crusaders, where I leaned into lots of the less well-known people. And so I wanted to do it different again. So I thought, let's make this just like proper greatest hits of the Middle Ages. So you're going to have Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan, and you're going to have Eleanor of Aquitaine and Joan of Arc, and you're going to have Frederick Hohenstauf and Martin Luther, and they're all going to be jumbled in, and they're going to topple over one another as you race through the pages. That just felt cool.
So I did it. It comes off as cool.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
Now, you say in the introduction, like, this is Eurocentric because that's what you study, and that's, you know, you have to have a certain scope and it's going to be Eurocentric. But you actually work even with the Mongols and you go all the way out to China a little bit. Why was it important to you to bring Asia into it?
Well, thinking about possible definitions of what could a new history of the Middle Ages look like, I thought that, again, somebody go do this book. A truly global history of the Middle Ages, that would be kind of interesting and cool, which gave equal precedence to the Americas, to Africa, to Asia, even to, you know, Australasia, Polynesia, as it did to Europe. The two things in my mind that persuaded me not to take that approach were, firstly, that, well, the Middle Ages is, by definition, a Christian ecclesiastical term. You can trace back to John Fox's Book of Martyrs, 1560s, you know, looking on what had just come before the Reformation, said, well, that's a sort of middle age. That is what defines it. And the second thing that persuaded me not to do a global history of the Middle Ages is just I'm completely unqualified to do it. I mean, even more unqualified than I was to write Powers and Thrones. So I just bring shame on my family. You know, and that's for somebody else to do. That's rightfully not my place.
Someone else is to bring shame on your family.
Yeah, someone that's anyone out there who wants to shame my family, just they're waiting for you. But then, having had that thought, right, well, okay, this is going to be effectively a Eurocentric history because it's about the Middle Ages, but own it and admit it up front. Don't pretend, like sneakily and snidely pretend you're doing something different. Say it, as I do say it in about the third paragraph of the book, and also then meet the modern world halfway. So what I've tried to say is, yes, this is a book which mostly has as its focus Europe, but I'm writing in the 21st century, and so we need to see how Europeans interacted with Asians, Europeans interacted with Africans, Europeans interacted with Americans to the extent that they did in the Middle Ages. And so then although the core was still familiar, maybe the peripheral scope of the book was bigger than normal. And in Powers and Thrones, yeah, I think it goes from Ireland to Korea, from the Arctic Circle to the Cape of Good Hope. There is a world, there is a bigger world than just France.
That's a shock to people who were writing histories of the Middle Ages like 200 years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, speaking of meeting the modern world halfway, one of the things that was mentioned, I think it was the New York Times review of the book, was saying you make analogies to modern things in here. Like, you talk about Amazon, you talk about monasteries being a spiritual McDonald's in this one liner that made me laugh out loud. Thank you for that. So why did you bring things like this into a book about the Middle Ages?
Because they made me laugh. You know, as I was sitting writing the book, these little comparisons with the modern world just kept coming to my head, and some of them I found amusing. And I thought, I've always shied away from putting those sort of things into the book. So I've reached, which the New York Times did not mention, a compromise, I hope, with readers. Some readers, I'm sure, some listeners to your podcast will be thinking, oh, gosh, yuck, I don't want to hear that Cluniac monasticism arranged around pilgrim routes resembled McDonald's along the freeways. Okay, I understand that could come across as crass and glib. It is a joke. And as such, I put these jokes in the footnotes. So you can actually just ignore them as you read through the book. And they're not in the audiobook.
Oh, okay.
Because we don't record footnotes in the audiobooks. The audiobook is somewhat less sprinkled with arch asides and attempts at humor than the physical book. So,
that must have been tough for you.
I didn't mind. I mean, it was a long read.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's a 700-page book. And there was only 7 hot days in the UK last summer when I recorded it. And in all of them, I was in the audio booth, which had no window and was about 6 foot by 6 foot. And was dark, apart from a small lamp and the light of an iPad, and had no air conditioning. And so I had to read this audiobook physically sweating and reading 7-8 hours a day, semi-naked. At one session, I just had my underwear on, reading an audiobook.
Who says medieval history is not sexy, right?
Right. Well, it wasn't that sexy. Certainly, when anyone opened the door, it was shocking. As I was recording, I said, after like a day or two of this, that every time I went into the booth, I would try and silently take all my clothes off and sit there. My producer couldn't see me, right? So after about a day and a half of this, I felt like we knew each other well enough and say, look, I'm going to tell you this now, just in case anyone comes into this booth. I'm sitting here mostly naked. And she went, yeah, that's completely normal. Almost everyone does it. It gets really hot in there, right? Like, oh, this is great.
Okay, good.
I thought I was going to get cancelled for this. She's like, no, everyone's naked reading.
He's such anyway, a diva. This is his process. You have to respect. You're going to ask for special M&Ms after this, right?
Anyway, that's all in the side. We were talking about jokes and
right.
What was another one? I was doing the chapter on Dante, the chapter about the Renaissance. And it begins, of course, with Dante and Petrarch and Terza Rima and sort of new avenues of vernacular Italian literature in the 13th, 14th centuries. And as I was writing this bit about Dante, and there's an episode at the beginning of the chapter which describes Francesco Filelfo giving a lecture about Dante in the cathedral in Florence during the sort of height of Cosimo de' Medici's power. And he's talking about Dante, and it starts a fight in which supporters of Cosimo attack Filelfo in the streets, and he gets stabbed in the, you know, brutally attacked and stabbed in the street a few days later because of what he's been saying using Dante. And I thought, well, as I'm writing, I'm thinking this is a new form of rhyme. Intricate rhyme patterns, super exciting racy subjects, dark imagery, unbelievably petty squabbles arising from it, and this spilling over into gang violence in the streets. And I grew up listening to a lot of hip hop in the 1990s, and this sure as shit sounds like Tupac and Biggie to me. So I just put a little footnote in that just says, we see this stuff come round and round again. The beginning of Powers and Thrones has the little epigram, and it's the preacher from the book of Ecclesiastes, the one that everyone gets their titles for famous novels from. He says, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. That's kind of the deep message. It means the Middle Ages doesn't have to be as scary as you think it is. We can feel familiarity here, but it's broken down in the little sort of micro instances throughout the book. It's like, you're going to see some shit that looks familiar.
Yeah. No, I like that because, well, I mean, I've always been on that page too, where this is familiar because people are so similar and you see this back in the day. I mean, I think you talk about football hooligans as well, because you get really far back into the ancient world.
Yeah, this again, this was chapter 4 is called Arabs, and it's a history of the origins of Islam, the first Islamic caliphates and the Arab conquests up till 750, then the fracturing of the Umayyad caliphate. Serious topic, quite difficult often for even people who are familiar with medieval history. Islamic history does tend to be slightly hived off in its own little subsection that people feel nervous about approaching or don't get to until they get to the First Crusade, and then there just seem to have been loads of Muslims everywhere. Do you know? So it's so it's not familiar territory to a lot of readers, and it's serious. You can't get this stuff wrong. So it was something that was not very familiar to me, and so I put a lot of really serious work into it. So it was nice to have a couple of these occasional moments of levity. And the example, well, there's two examples in golf football, so maybe I picked the wrong one. But one of the examples is talking about the Arabs seeing themselves as the sons of Ishmael. And of Ishmael, it was said, he was a wild ass of a man, and his hand was against everyone's, and everyone's against his. Now, followers of English football, although not Premier League football, the lower divisions, were maybe aware of a club called Millwall FC, who for a time, perhaps even still, had a reputation as having the most violent and feared fans in the whole of England. Millwall, the den where they play in South London, was not a nice place to visit, and their travelling fans were really nasty. And their terrorist chant was, "No one likes us, we don't care." I thought, this is the same thing. Everyone's scared of these people. But they know what they're all about. So in that, so again, there's a little footnote. If you find that offensive or crass, great, just skip the footnote. But maybe you're also talking about the chapter on Byzantium, which is the preceding chapter, chapter three.
Yeah.
Right, so then it's the Hippodrome factions, the Blues and the Greens, the Nico riots, Justinian Theodora. And look, the Blues and Greens watching the chariot racing in the Hippodrome in Constantinople and in the 6th century, man, that is just, that's football terrorist stuff.
Yeah.
Probably more similar to Italian football, like ultras.
I will take your word for that.
In Italian football, football hooliganism is considerably more politicized than it is in British football. In British football, sorry, let's be precise, English football, by and large, terrorist culture, I mean soccer, by the way, Americans, terrorist culture is not that concerned with politics, except insofar as for a lot of northern clubs, it will have a broadly socialist element to its worldview. I'm literally waggling my finger at you. Less so in Italy, where the elision of politics and football hooliganism is somewhat closer. And maybe in Spain as well, I don't really know. Well, in Constantinople in the 6th century, you had the main two factions, the Blues and the Greens, who followed the chariot racing, were heavily involved in politics as well. And so they took political positions, and there was a degree of cultural political negotiation between the emperor and the political powers in Constantinople and these football hooligans. And they had kind of trendy haircuts, and they wore like the dope threads, and they had a look, and they were kind of prone to easy violence. And they were just super into sport, and they were quite prickly and thin-skinned and easy to offend. This is football hooliganism. It just is. It's the same thing. It just happens to be in Constantinople about 1,400 years ago.
It's true. People are people. I love that you threw in the haircuts and the dope threads, because you need to have markers if you're going to be part of a group like that, right? You need to show
off. For sure, yeah.
The amazing sandals, you know. The best trends. Well,
yeah, and you know what? Look, you're more of an expert on this, much more of an expert on this than I am. However, this observation on my part, you can set me straight. When we interact with the Middle Ages on television, in drama, there's really only one haircut.
Yeah.
Or maybe there's two. But it's just long hair for the dudes and like an immense plait for the women. And that's the medieval haircut. Now, I'm going to set aside The Last Duel, the Ridley Scott movie that just came out. Did you see that?
Yeah, well, I reviewed it for the podcast, so we talked about mullets.
So you talked about Matt Damon's mullet. Okay, but the fact that that's a huge talking point in this film shows us just how poorly represented changing fashions in the Middle Ages have been in film hitherto. I mean, look, you might do Henry V and give him all pudding bowls.
Yeah.
But by and large, this sense that in the Middle Ages, there were sort of rapidly changing fashions, and that sometimes styles were in and then they'd move and styles would be out, doesn't get very represented. But it would be weird to think that didn't happen, that there was just a sort of staid kind of fashionlessness until you get to like the 16th century.
Between togas and corsets. There's nothing.
Yeah. That's it, right? Of course, it can't be true.
Well, it's sometimes mullets. Okay, so speaking of stuff that there could be more of in general, so you have this gigantic book, but you're covering 1,000 years. You must have had to cut some things out. You know, you have to kill your darlings.
No, it's all in there. It's all in there.
Yeah, no.
No, of course. Not. Look, it's not an including job. It's an excluding job.
Yeah. So what were your favorite things that you couldn't put in? Which darlings did you have to kill for this book? That's a writer's term, everyone.
It's not. Yeah. I feel like I'm going to like turn people off buying it if I tell you. Hey, your favorite thing. It's not in there.
Everything else is in there.
I'll tell you. So the Plantagenets don't get a good showing in Powers and Thrones. Like they make it in here and there. And certainly the chapter on builders, there's a chapter on castles and cathedrals. Edward I looms large. The chapter on merchants, the commercial revolution, there's a wee bit of Edward III and the England's interactions with the banks of Italy. Henry II, not a lot. Eleanor of Aquitaine's there, but in the context of the Crusades, they're sort of Lancastrians. Forget about it. They just don't even figure. Richard III only charges through because I believe, if I get this right, I only mention once in comparison with Da Vinci, because they're born in the same year. And I'm trying to place Da Vinci's or make Da Vinci's incredible genius seem all the more surprising that this dude was born the same year as Richard. So I left most of the Plantagenets out, and that was not through choice. I would have had them all in there because, as some of your listeners will know, I'm all about the Plantagenets.
Well, luckily, but there's a book for that, right?
There's a book for that. Yeah, and it would have been handy just to transpose quite a lot of the Plantagenets into Powers and Thrones, but it'd also be cheating the reader, of course. So I'm not into it. Partly, look, here's why. When you're telling the story of the Middle Ages, I'm sorry to say it, but England, for the most part, in the big, big sort of helicopter story where you're seeing from very, very far away, isn't that important? It's not that important. And so that was not a surprise to me, but actually getting into the weeds of writing this book and going, well, when am I going to get the Plantagenet? Oh, goodness, this is odd. That was like an applied example. It gave me an applied understanding of all that stuff that I was so immersed in writing Plantagenets, Wars of the Roses, Magna Carta, Peasant's Revolt. There's another way of looking at this world in which this doesn't matter. And look, to go back to something we talked about earlier, if someone goes and writes the grand global history of the Middle Ages, almost everything in Powers and Thrones won't make it in either. Mm-hmm. It's about your perspective, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, as you're saying this, I'm thinking like, this is kind of what being a medievalist is all about. You spend all this time like, oh, the Middle Ages is so cool. And you speak to someone else and they have no idea. So it's familiar. It's familiar to be like, oh, this is very specialized, but you forget that it's specialized sometimes when you're working on it.
Of course. Yeah. And it's always helpful to step outside your comfort zone and step outside your specialty as a writer, as an academic, as a student, as a scholar, whatever, as a researcher. It's very helpful to have perspective. You know, I've written a couple of books with Marina Amaral, these brilliant digitally colorized photography, and these are modern history books. It isn't too much bearing on my medieval work at all, but it's refreshing every now and again to just get away from the period, even if so when you come back, you see it afresh. It's like going on vacation for a month and coming back and go, oh, I do like the place that I live after all. Or not, or going, do you know what? I hate this place and I have to leave and move. It's helpful to gain outside perspective.
Yeah, and I think that really works. And actually, writer to writer, one of the things I admire most in this particular book is you have a chapter on Crusaders. You've written about Crusaders twice. And so that could be a really bloated chapter, but you've got this so streamlined so that you explain everything well, and I think thoroughly, but it doesn't get overdone. Did that take a lot of work, actually, that chapter, to try and like whittle down two books worth of information into one chapter? Or did you just have sound bites from having interviews?
Well, I write the book sequentially. So I write from start to finish. And that chapter on Crusaders comes out of the two chapters on monks and knights. So Crusaders is chapter 8, I believe, and monks and knights is chapters 6 and 7. And so I'd approached it through this chapter that, Chapter 6 about monks is really about the rise of Cluniac monasticism. That's what anchors the chapter. It says, you know, what are the reformed movements of Benedictine monasticism but really exemplified through the Cluniacs. Like, what's going on with monasticism around the first millennium and into about the year 1300? And then the chapter on knights does the same. What is this thing? What is this weird social archetype, if that's the right word, probably not, of the knight? What's special about this? And the chapter's all about the intersection between a literature and reality. Now, that's a very different angle of approach to the Crusades than I'd taken with, certainly with Templars, and again with Crusaders, come at them from a different angle. So, you know, I wrote my way into the chapter on Crusaders with different priorities, and I wrote my way through it knowing that the Mongols were coming next, that that was going to be my chapter 9. And so that I had this idea that chapter 9 about the Mongols was going to start in the Fifth Crusade, and so that really the arc was going to bend towards Innocent III and kind of not go much further. And I certainly didn't want to get into the Ottomans and the later Crusades, because I knew that would be coming at the back of the book. Mm. Okay, we're talking story architecture now, which we said we wouldn't do. But my point is that the framing matters in how you tell a story. And the framing for writing about Crusades in this book was different. That being said, I think it's the longest chapter in the book. I think it's slightly longer than the chapter about the Arab conquests, because there is just a mass of information to get in there. And also because the Crusades are really important in understanding medieval history in Europe. You know, the fall of Jerusalem 1099 is a pivotal moment in Western history. Pivotal.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're still living with it now. So it had to be a long chapter. But yeah, I was also very conscious, this can't just be like a little sort of shrunk down Lego Man version of Crusaders. It's got to have a different vibe to it and fit in this book.
It's fair to have a big chapter on Crusades, because I think a lot of people come to the Middle Ages through Crusades, and you have to do that work of explaining back to it that it's not as black and white as people think. And so that's the stuff that I really admired about how you did that chapter, is explaining this stuff. And I think your books are marketed very well, and you have a really good eye for like what's going to be attractive to people who are not specialists, right? Like, if you have these chapters to the books that are called these names, it's going to bring the people. And I think that's really good, but that shouldn't make people think that you don't get into these things really in depth and take them apart and really explain. You know, people have this misconception about Crusaders. There are many points in it where you say, well, hang on for a second, let's just take this apart before we move on and really talk about how this might be a myth in our way of thinking right now that needs to be looked at before we can move to the next thing.
Right. And so maybe we've slightly missold this book by talking about the jokes first and the serious stuff second. But,
will get people to this point.
Okay. The books are marketed at a general audience, right? Because at heart, I want more people to be interested in the Middle Ages.
Me too.
Once you get in, it's going to be easy to read and fun and serious.
Yeah.
And full of information and thinking about the Middle Ages, because once upon a time, long, long time ago, I was a relatively serious medieval historian, and I took this stuff seriously, and I read all this stuff. I read it all.
That's what I'm trying to tell people. You are a serious historian who makes great jokes.
But so that's what's in the books. Anyone, I hope, that reads the books will immediately understand it. Might be your cup of tea, might not be your cup of tea. I can't do anything about that, but I do stand by the integrity of historical integrity of these books, as well as the accessibility, and that's as much as I can do. I sleep very easy at night knowing that I do the hard work, and then if it's so deceptively accessible people think it must be bullshit, okay, just go follow the endnotes. It's all there.
Yeah, it's all there. Well, I mean, I wouldn't have you back again on the podcast if I thought
God bless
it was all
you.
Bullshit. Yeah, no, you do the work. You do the work. And I wanted to bring that up because I think that sometimes, you know, you reach a certain level of notoriety and people just assume you don't do the work, but you do the work. Okay. I think you've sold that book really well just now by saying, you know, all the things you did about how it's really accessible, but it's good work. So tell us about the next thing you're doing, because the next thing you're doing is totally different for you, and it's going to be super cool.
Well, I'm writing the first of three novels set in the Hundred Years' War. I am actually going back to just England and France, having left it out of Powers of Thrones. You know, now we're doing something different. So the first novel of three projected, maybe more, is called Essex Dogs. And it's coming out next October. And it's set in 1346 in the Edward III's Cressy campaign. And the idea had been kind of brewing for a little while. You and I, we mentioned before we started recording that you and I in 2015, you said, had a conversation. I was talking about doing fiction then. Like, my God. Well, I didn't do anything about it. I didn't really have an idea. 2017, I woke up on an aeroplane. I mean, I knew I was on, I'd got onto the aeroplane. No, I didn't wait. This isn't Mission Impossible. I didn't wake up on an aeroplane. I was on an aeroplane. I fell asleep. I woke up. I'd been dozing. And I just had this idea. This gang of freebooter kind of, you can't really call them soldiers. They go and fight and they go and rob. It's really the soldiers of fortune, I suppose you might call them, around the time just before the Black Death, the early stages of the Hundred Years' War. I didn't really know what to do with them. I tried to write them up into some kind of story, but the story wasn't there. So I shelved it again. 2019, the new year of 2019, the innocent times. I went to Normandy for New Year. I had like a house and had a bunch of my friends come stay. And we kind of hung around in Normandy in the sort of chilly, bleak midwinter. And on New Year's Day, we went down to Omaha Beach and visited. We didn't actually visit the American Cemetery. I don't think it was open. But we walked around Omaha Beach and we talked about the history of D-Day and tried unsuccessfully to imagine what it would have been like and what we'd have done had we been there. All the stuff that everyone does when they go to the Normandy beaches. I came back. I was still buzzing around my head. I read a bunch of stuff about D-Day, like a lot of testimony from people who'd been on Omaha Beach. And then it started to just elide in my mind with this idea I had about fiction in the Middle Ages. And I was like, well, the same beach, it's a little further up the coast, just up from Utah Beach, where Edward III in July 1346 landed 15,000 men. But what's the difference? I mean, I don't want to be getting off a landing craft with Bob Capper taking my picture and Messerschmitts and machine guns on the 6th of June 1944. But I also don't want to be there on July 1346, right? So I thought, well, okay, what here's this scene. It's the beginning of Saving Private Ryan, or it's the beginning of Band of Brothers. Only it's 1346, it just happens to be, but otherwise the mood is the same. It's not, hey, nonny, no, my liege. Hey, knighty, prithee tell, sire. All that shit. It's like, it's hard. It feels like a Vietnam novel or a Korea novel or a World War II novel. It's got that sensibility. It's like Platoon or Full Metal Jacket or Apocalypse Now, kind of in movie terms. These guys are going to get off the landing craft and they're going to have to just survive a campaign. And this is going to be the Cressy campaign. So the Black Prince will show up a bit and the Devil Warwick will show up a bit and, you know, Edward III will be around. So I just had this idea. I didn't know what to do with it. And I, you know, to rehash a phrase from earlier this interview, I thought I'd bring shame on my family by attempting. Anyway, here's a name drop for you. In the summer of 2019, I had dinner with George R.R. Martin, creator of Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. We'd done an interview in London. We had dinner. Unbelievably fascinating and brilliant man who spent 50 years writing all sorts of things, but is super interested in history. He just had so much fun. After that conversation, I sort of thought, no, I'm going to try this. And I read a few chapters and sent it to a couple of publishers. My UK publishers, Head of Zeus, backed me to go for it for three books. Because I said I want to do 1346 as D-Day and then the Normandy campaign. 1347, Siege of Calais as Stalingrad. And then there's a third one, which I keep changing my mind about. But I said, I'm not going to tell you. A cycle of novels and some of the characters come through. And stylistically, it's like James Ellroy and Lee Child having a fight in, you know, medieval times. I don't know. It's going to be like hardcore.
I love it.
But that's what I'm doing. I've nearly finished. I've got 4 or 5 chapters left to write and I'm delivering it at Christmas and it's coming out in October. And it's pretty scary in a way.
Yeah.
Because I haven't done it before.
Yeah.
It's a totally different way of writing. Totally different. And I struggled for 3 or 4 months, maybe longer actually, to just work out what I was going to do. I talked to George. I talked to Bernard Cornwell. Where they both said, you can't control fiction writing the way you can control nonfiction. If I'm writing a nonfiction chapter, I can sit down and muscle 2,500 words in a writing session if I'm really, I have to, and I've got the research and the reading done. you can't muscle fiction. You might write more than that in a session, but the characters will do things that you don't expect, and things will happen that you don't see coming. And you've got to put yourself onto the right vibration or frequency mentally to be ready to accept the story instead of imposing order on something that a story that is already waiting for you to move it around. And that is a fundamentally different. At the beginning, when I started doing it, I literally, this is obviously not true, but I literally felt like I could feel a different bit of my brain at work. But what I couldn't work out was how to put myself into that mode. It was like your car has four-wheel drive mode and sports mode and economy mode and comfort mode, but you don't know where the button is that cycles between them. And you're stuck in like economy mode and you need to go off-road. Okay, it's like, I don't know how to do this. And it's super frustrating. And then you just find where the button is. And
it's that simple. You just find where the button is.
So now I can sit down and go, okay, well, I've just written a proposal for another nonfiction book. I can go into nonfiction mode and press the button, and then I can go into fiction mode. So I've learned that technique. So I love to learn stuff. So that's great.
But that's good. I was going to ask you how it felt, because you are such a structured writer.
By the way, I just kissed my dog and not you. Just if there was a kissing noise on the microphone. He's getting antsy on my lap. I just thought like that would be weird if people.
Well, that's harsh.
Well, you're in Toronto. I'm in London. It would be also physically impossible. The dog is on my lap. You're 3,500 miles away.
I forgot what we were talking about. Right. So, so the new novel, totally different way of doing things. Well, I mean, good luck to you doing the last few chapters. I can't wait to read it. It's going to be awesome. You come back here, right?
If you cover such downmarket things as trashy medieval historical fiction, in a way, it's like more scary, do you know, because people for some reason pick more holes in fiction for historical details, I feel like, than they do for nonfiction. Don't you think people are just waiting for the fiction, or particularly, I maybe this is just like from the TV production I've done. People are just like waiting for, that's wrong. Got you.
Yeah.
Whereas in nonfiction, you have more of a sort of, you come with more kind of gravitas.
Maybe they don't read it. They're already watching the fiction, whatever. They're already watching it. So, thanks so much for coming on. I mean, Powers and Thrones is such a good book. And congratulations. I know it's doing well, and I hope it continues to do well. We need it in Canada. It's not here yet.
Since it comes to Canada?
I don't think so. But let me double check on that before we put this out.
You're always behind the curve. What is that?
Just with your stuff, dude. Just with your stuff. But you can get it through Book Depository usually. And that's how people are getting it, I think. But everyone else can get Powers and Thrones, and they should check it out. Thanks for coming on, Dan.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
To find out more about Dan Jones's work, you can follow him on Twitter at DG Jones. His new book is Powers and Thrones, A New History of the Middle Ages, and is out now. To follow up on our discussion of availability in Canada, Canadians can get it in ebook form now, hardcover later, or sooner through international booksellers. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new this week, Peter?
Hey, well, this week is all about you because you've had such a great week.
I've had a busy week, one of the busiest and coolest weeks of my career.
You slayed it on Twitch.
I tried my best to slay it on Twitch. I mean, there's people slaying on Twitch. I just joined up. Yeah, I was on simulation mode, which we talked a little bit about before. And people can still catch that replay on twitch.tv/crown, or they can find it on YouTube on Crown Channel. But yeah, I was doing color commentary on medieval fighting in a ring, like armored combat. It was pretty awesome. You watched it, right, Peter?
Yeah, I watched it. I was watching it live, and it was great. If you haven't had a chance, just watch it. Just watch it for Danielle. It was a fun show, so I was really happy to watch it. You're off in LA, being all Hollywood, and now you've come back to another book, now officially published.
Yeah. So I came back. I was telling the people in LA, actually, it was a good distraction because my new book finally came out. So it kept me from being too nervous about that. I was nervous about something else. So yeah, How to Live Like a Monk came out today, the day we're recording it, which is November 23rd, which is very exciting. And the love that I have felt today on social media has just been outstanding. And I just really want to say how grateful I am to everybody who pre-ordered the book, everybody who's like hyping it on social media, everybody who's sending me pictures that they have it in hand. It's just been so amazing. And I cannot express my gratitude deeply enough to all of the people out there who are just being so supportive of the book and my work in general. Just like, thank you, everybody. It means so much to me.
It is awesome. Congratulations for both of these things. What a week for you. So
yeah.
Yay.
Banner week. It's been awesome. Hey, but it's not just me that's doing stuff. What else is going on medievalist.net?
Well, I was in the most medieval city in North America, which is Quebec City, just this weekend.
Oh man,
that was such a wonderful place, full of history. If you'll be on our social media, you'll see like, you know, photos from museums and maybe a few sites and things like that. It was a bit of a quiet week for medievalist.net, but we have a new episode of Bow and Blade. And this one, Kelly and Michael did a Q&A episode answering listener questions like, what was a cavalry charge like? And which medieval king would they want to live under? So that was fun.
Wow, that's a great question. I need to listen to this podcast because I know Michael and Kelly, and I really want to hear what their answers are to that.
Yeah, indeed. So please check that out. We also got pieces on why the Viking raiding ended in the 11th century and medieval confederates and like how it was like to be with a gang of people all happy to be under one saint, partying it up.
Partying it up is the theme of the week here at medievalist.net.
Indeed.
That sounds amazing. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to all of our patrons on patreon.com for your support each month. We have great stuff for patrons, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine and the Medieval magazine, our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. All of these things might make pretty awesome gifts for a medieval lover. Just saying. To get in on all the action, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. And finally, if you've been waiting for my new book, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, to come out, but you haven't grabbed a copy yet, or you want another copy for friends and family, you're in luck. My publisher, Abbeville Press, has a special offer just for my favorite people of 20% off if you order it directly from their website. Just go to abbeville.com, that's ABBEVILLE.com, look up How to Live Like a Monk and use the code Benedict, as in Saint Benedict, to get 20% off the cover price as a special gift from me to you. We'll also have the link in the show notes on medievalist.net. Thanks for supporting me and the book. For everything from sweeping epics to sleeping beauty, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even find a copy of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which is out now in North America and very soon in the UK. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.